It's a full-blown MATLAB license. Okay.
We talk at class?
Yeah.
Okay. So, how did the recitation section go?
Pretty well.
Kyle's a pretty good guy. I like Kyle a lot. And this is the first time he's taught, so I'm kind of pushing him a little bit. But if he doesn't get it right, you know, I'll be glad to help. But I think you'll find him a really good person to work with. And he's very good at math, to, at the programming. He knows a lot of different languages. The recitation class last night, Kyle, a good graduate student.
You had mentioned maybe having one on Thursday.
If there's demand for that, we could schedule a second class on Thursday.
Thursday works much better for me, I think. Yeah, because I have last Tuesday, Wednesday.
I don't want to, you know, make him do it twice. But
well, how many people cannot attend the class on Tuesday and would attend the class on Thursday?
I have to leave like 45 minutes.
I would like it Thursday.
Okay. So I'll have Taos do a second class on Thursday.
No, this is
Tom's first chance to teach, so this is a good experience for him. In fact, the second class will probably be better because he won't make the same mistakes twice. Okay, so you were going to talk about IEEE, so why don't you go ahead and stand up and introduce yourself.
I'm Jacob Bowen. I'm the current treasurer for the IEEE student branch here. And in case you've gotten to this point somehow without knowing what IEEE is, it is the Institute for Electrical and Electronics Engineers. It's a really good professional society to be a part of. You have access to tons of information. As a student member, you get a subscription to Spectrum magazine. And you also, I think, still get a subscription to Potentials magazine, which you get once every 2 months. And also tons of information online that you have access to, lots of articles and stuff like that. Also, if I'm not mistaken, we're still looking for a web design officer, someone to be a web admin, anyone who has some experience with web development. Our website could really be updated. That's the main thing, I guess. It's the largest professional technical society around the world. There are a lot of members. I don't know how many off the top of my head.
Millions.
Yeah. So
can I embellish something?
Sure.
What's the next meeting?
Like the actual next presentation? I'm not sure. When is it, Gary?
We haven't scheduled one yet. First meeting's going to be either with ATRAN or Alabama Power. So they come in and get their usual technical presentation. We'll probably recruit employment opportunities.
And free food.
Another benefit.
Thank you very much. So let me add a few things because I've been very involved in the IEEE for a while. So why should you, as a student who typically doesn't have a lot of money, be very interested in the IEEE? Well, many of you, when you get out into industry, are going to be getting some of your benefits through the IEEE. For example, a lot of my colleagues and myself included, get life insurance through the IEEE because it's a good deal and it's often cheaper than what your company will offer you. In the world you guys are moving into as engineers is a lot different than the engineering world was 30 years ago. Tell me a little bit about your perception of the issue of benefits as you become practicing engineers over the next 20, 30 years. You know, you've heard, for example, with the auto industry, a lot of talk about the fact that GM can't be competitive because they $4,000 per car goes to health insurance and things like this, right? You've seen some of these statements. So tell me about your perceptions of this as people who are about to enter the engineering workforce and how this is going to influence you as engineers. This is something you really need to be thinking about. It relates to the IEEE.
Start now and do it yourself.
Yeah.
As far as retirement goes.
Start
now and do it yourself, because a lot of companies are going away from the centralized retirement.
So what are some of the buzzwords they use to try to explain to you basically that they're not giving you the benefits that they used to give you? They have all these cute little catch terms, and they have the nice little HR person come in and smile and tell you all this stuff. And you, wait a second, did you just tell me I'm not getting health insurance?
Independent of the freedom to get your own health insurance.
So what do they call that?
That's pretty much how they put it.
So it's, they use terms like supermarket benefits. You can pick and choose. But you know, as a, what you look at that someday, especially if you get married and have kids and don't get married, whatever. You look at things. Now wait a second. You know, I've got kids. I've got a family. I need health insurance. I need life insurance. I add all those things up. That all isn't covered from you as in your benefits package. Because what they're basically trying to do is to save money by offering you some things and not offering you other things. And that's often called supermarket benefits. It goes by a number of different things. Another thing that companies like GM are facing is that they cannot afford the pension plans that they promised all their retirees. So imagine, you know, you've retired, conditioned on you're going to get in tonight pension, and one day your company tells you we're not going to give you that anymore. So what's another way that you sort of hedge against that?
One thing they do, like, they won't even come out and tell you that they're ending it. I've seen companies in Mississippi like GE will just wait till the average or bulk of the people are about to retire and move the entire factory to another country. So they may not even come out and tell you and be nice about it. They may just, oh, this light bulb company is going to go to Mexico.
Right, and I don't want to get to be too hard on companies, but when I was at Texas Instruments, we used to joke every year it got time for them to pay near time to pay profit sharing. They'd announce they were building a new building, and we'd always say, "Oops, there goes our profit sharing," because they would claim all these expenses and therefore couldn't pay profit sharing, and it was kind of a joke. So your hedge against all this is to be very involved in organizations like the IEEE, and many of you, more so in your lifetimes than my lifetime, are going to be getting a lot of your benefits through alternate means, whether it's through professional societies or through group plans. When I was out in Maryland for the past 3 years, and they have a lot of contractors there, so there are a lot of companies that specialize in insurance packages for contractors, and they sort of build group plans out of groups of contractors, all working for different companies and things. Some of you will start your own businesses, and you'll be worried about how you're going to provide good benefits to your employees. Well, the IEEE is a really good deal because they use the fact that there's millions of IEEE members to get good group rates on a lot of health insurance, life insurance, and things. And the life insurance has been a good deal. I've used it for many years, and we've looked at the health insurance quite a bit. I've never quite taken it, but a lot of my friends who are contractors do get their health insurance through the IEEE. Retirement benefits, which we alluded to earlier, very important. I feel very important that you look hard at where you're getting your retirement benefits from, because planning on a company to be around 30, 40 years from now and paying you benefits, odds are not good that company's going to survive that long. So you may think about getting more and more of your benefits through the IEEE. So don't think of the IEEE just as this technical society where people get together and play games with resistors and capacitors and whatnot. I mean, this is really about, it's almost like a union, and I don't really like unions, but it's very close to a union in that it's a way you as an engineer have a voice provided by this very large organization that spans the world and has a lot of political power in terms of making sure that the governments do the right thing in terms of protecting engineers and stuff. There was another question.
I also wonder if you can get student health insurance from IEEE, like with your student membership.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, and I think that's a question the IEEE should be.
I think you can.
Is there a discounted student plan?
I think I've been writing a lot of stuff in mail like that.
The health insurance is expensive, but usually as students you get a little better rates on things. As grad students, those of you going to grad school, you'll also face this kind of an issue because some of you are getting insurance through your parents' plans. You won't be covered as graduate students, and either you'll get it through the university or you get it through professional societies and things. And, it's well worth the money. Now, another reason you become an IEEE member is you get cheap discounts on registration to conferences. So hopefully many of you will have a chance to go to a professional conference sometime during your education here. And if that happens, your advisor will make you come join the IEEE because the cost of the membership is much less than what you save on the conference registration. And I can't say enough about getting involved in the IEEE early. Another reason to get involved early is at some point in your careers, you're going to want to get promoted to senior member of the IEEE and hopefully eventually other awards above that. And the clock starts ticking when you join as a student member. And sometimes your companies will pay you more money once you become a senior member and things. So get that clock ticking as early as possible. Join now and you pick up a couple extra years of service, and that'll pay for itself down the line when you're able to get promoted earlier and things like that.
What's the senior member classification? What's that actually?
You get to pay higher for what we do. That's one. So, what is the? I mean, theoretically, about 2% of all members become senior members, or something like that. It's an honor you have to apply for. You have to get people to recommend you, and supposedly there's a committee that makes sure you're really good and all this. But it's been almost automatic for most of the people I've been involved with.
So it's more an honor than.
Yeah, it's more of an honor, but it's a nice thing. When you begin to do professional resumes, if you aren't already, you will soon. Certainly when you graduate, you will list your professional societies and things. If nothing else, the IEEE gives you one that makes you look like you're community active. Today's lecture, by the way, is not in the book, so we have a little bit of disposable time here. But let me say a couple more things about this, because I think it's really important to think about these things. What is the average, when you graduated as an engineer in the 1960s, and I know some of you probably weren't even born then, but you certainly have heard about those times in history books and things. What was your life like as an engineer? Why were people so interested in becoming engineers in the 1960s? What was your life like?
Most more hands-on.
Well, not technical stuff, but sort of.
It's the world.
Why did people want to become engineers in the 60s? Well, because they would get married, they would go work for a GM or a GE or a Westinghouse, and they would work at the same place their whole career, live in the same town their whole career, you know, and have a nice, and actually, in retrospect, I think it was a pretty nice life. So people became engineers back then because you got paid well, you had job stability, you got to do really interesting work. And generally, the chances of you working for one company your entire career were very, very high. And contrast that with what's your life as engineers graduating today going to be like? Less. Many of you within your first 3 or 4 years out of school are going to go through your first job change. Many of you will go through 7 to 8 job changes over the course of your career. Many of you will live in many different places throughout your life. Now that has some profound implications. It's not all bad. I mean, I've lived in Japan, I've lived in many different places in the U.S. I've enjoyed a lot of getting a chance to do a lot of different things. It's not all that bad, but it does change the way you view things. Like, you have to be a little bit worried about how you invest in real estate, like your house and things like that. But more importantly, what's going to be really important in your career is to stay ahead of layoffs and things like that. You know, when companies go through layoffs like they are going to be now, and the next year is going to be pretty rough for a lot of companies, especially in the electronics industry. You never want to get laid off, right? You always want to be ahead of that curve. Now, how do you manage your career so that you're ahead of the layoff curve? You're always in demand, essentially.
Find another job.
So if you're a good engineer, how do you find jobs? And this is a trick question.
Networking.
Close.
close.
Jobs find you.
There we go. Excellent. Jobs find you. Many of you, 2-3 years out, especially if you go to work for a top company in your field, all the other companies want to gain the expertise from that company. So 2-3 years out, you're having meetings with a customer. Pretty soon that customer is going to pull you aside and say, hey, why don't you come work for us? How much? I'll pay you more money and I'll give you, you know, a nicer office and a better job. So jobs, if you're very active in a field, jobs will come to you. And that's not a bad thing. And that's how you stay, one of the ways you stay ahead of the curve. Now another way that you, I've always argued, one of the ways you prevent being laid off, or you always make sure you're in that group of people that a company values, is you increase your value outside the company. You make the company almost afraid to hire, to fire you, because all this good stuff is going to walk out the door to their competitor. And there's a lot of truth in that. So let's now bring all this back to IEEE. So how do you get into this kind of a situation where things are finding you? Well, you network. How do you network? You get active in the IEEE. How do you increase your value outside the company? You work in the IEEE, you get involved in the IEEE, you help organize conferences, you know, you publish papers in some cases, you go to conferences. There's a lot of different things you can do. All this stuff is really important in managing the long-term aspects of your career. So do become members of the IEEE. It's really important because it's a way that you you sort of, it's bigger than your company, if you will. It's a way you remain a member of the community, and you have access to a lot of opportunity. Do go to conferences. Companies always complain about spending money on travel to conferences. Oh, it's so expensive. What are you going to learn there? Fight it. Force them to send you to one or two conferences a year. Conferences are very important. That's how you network with your colleagues. After a few years of going to a conference, it becomes the place where you catch up with all your friends, and you know, you sort of keep in touch with the community. Do be politically active. Through things, organizations like the IEEE, you'll have chances to get involved in public policy making and things like that. You can even go to Washington as an IEEE fellow and spend a year in the White House or spend a year in Congress. Think about those kinds of opportunities, because we as engineers have to do more politically. Why are doctors paid so much and make so much money and have such a nice life? They have political clout. They control the market for doctors. Engineers have been very bad at doing this. And that's why our salaries have gone down over the past. If you look at real dollars, our salaries have been dropping for the past 40 years. Now, I don't think we should function like the doctors and limit the number of engineers and all that, but we've been very poor at being politically active, and the IEEE has been trying to change that over the past 20, 30 years. So anyway, that's my spiel about the IEEE. It's a good organization. It's a lot better. I grew up in Chicago where unions were really big. The IEEE is a lot better than being, there's been talk that engineers should join the AFL-CIO or some of that kind of stuff. Let's hope it never comes to that. And the IEEE is the way we prevent that. All right, so that was more interesting than what we're going to talk about, which is statistics. And I know you just love to talk about statistics.
This is what we did about 67% of the time.
Alright.
Good luck.
Okay, so I want to talk about a couple things today. One is what a digital signal is, and then the rest of the time we'll spend talking a little bit about statistics and how we use statistics to model signals. Most of this is not in the book, but throughout the semester, I'll do at a few points, I'll introduce concepts that are a little bit beyond the scope of the normal course, but I think I want you to get some exposure to these things. And I think with statistics, it's important that, you know, how many people have had probability statistics? Most of you should have had that by now, right? But you haven't.
No.
Are you going to soon? So you may be wondering, you know, why do we teach you, or why do we force you to take statistics? Well, we use statistics a lot in signal processing for many different things. So I want to make that connection in this course. So let's first talk about digital signals. A discrete time signal, x of n, we've introduced this notation. It's discrete in time, but continuous in amplitude.
which means that the amplitude is represented as a real number. This is, when we write X of N in a textbook, this is what we mean. Now, this is not what happens in MATLAB, right? When you represent a vector in MATLAB, the amplitude value of that vector, you know, if you write X of 3 and you print the value X of 3, what is it printing when it prints that value? Is it, in fact, printing a real number that can take on any value?
Of course not.
No. Of course not. Why?
Because it's on a computer.
It's on the computer. So computers go one step further. We don't really deal with X of N. We deal with something close to X of N, and that's called a digital signal. So we often approximate real numbers in digital electronics using a floating point numeric representation. In MATLAB, we use a 4-byte floating point, IEEE floating point number, for example, and there's a link if you want to learn more about that. A 4-byte floating point number uses 32 bits in its representation, which allows it to achieve 2 to the 32 different values. Now, that's a large number, but that's not an infinite number of values. And in fact, in signal processing, when you do lots of computation with floating point numbers, you run into numerical precision problems. And part of what signal processing engineers have to do is to figure out how to work around the limited precision of computers. Even in double precision, we have problems sometimes. The simplest way to assign these values would be to use a linear representation, which means to divide the range from rmin to rmax. Decide your number is going to vary from one minimum value to maximum value, and to split that into 2 to the 32 equal steps. So 2 to the 32 is like 2 billion. So you take rmin, rmax minus rmin, divide it by 2 billion, and those are the numbers that you can represent in this scale. Now, does this make sense? To use a uniform precision across this entire range from your minimum value, which could be minus, you know, 50 billion, to your maximum value, plus 50 billion.
Depends on your application.
It depends on your application. If you were building a digital computer today, would you handle floating point numbers that way? Well, if you think about that problem hard enough, you'll realize that this kind of uniform precision doesn't work well because it favors the very ends of this extreme. The difference between 0 and 1, the numbers 0 and 1 in that range, minus 50 billion to plus 50 billion, would be very small. If you take 100 billion and you divide it by 2 to the 32, you're going to have 2 to the 32 is about 2 billion, so you're going to have steps which are, I would say 100 billion divided by 2 billion, 50 billion, you'll have like, 50 billion steps, you know, steps which are a billion wide or larger, right? Which means the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 are all going to be represented by the same number. That's a problem. So how do computers actually do this in the real world? Well, they use a logarithmic representation. They assign so many bits to the mantissa, so many bits to the exponent, and then you do your computations in a logarithm space. Now, it's important to understand what that means. When you add two numbers together on a computer, if you add, 1 plus 3, most of the time you'll get 4, but some of the time you'll actually get 3.99999 because this kind of a computers are not, do not have unlimited precision. There's a finite precision associated with them. An example of where you encounter this kind of thing. There are a lot of different places you see this problem. You see it particularly in audio processing. In the early days of digital recorders, you could see this. We actually, at one time in my lab, we had a stack of 5 digital audio tape machines. And we started them at exactly the same time, 0, and we let them run for 2 hours, what we thought was 2 hours. When we were done, What time did all those machines show exactly the same time? No, they were off by several seconds. Why was that? Well, they have internal counters that are accumulating numbers over long periods of time. 2 hours on these machines is, you know, at 48,000 samples per second, it's like a billion calculations or something. Well, by the time they do those calculations, there's some error that's accumulated, and they're all off by a little bit. And this is actually a problem in digital recording that you often don't hear about. When you transfer data from one MP3 player to another, the clocks of those machines are off slightly. And over long periods of time, they will produce different results. So there's some special techniques you have to do to make sure things stay in synchronization. Now, do all devices work with floating point? No. Floating point is a very expensive way to implement algorithms. Very often, we want to implement algorithms in fixed point arithmetic, which means integers. And we do that because we can build devices like these that use much less power and fit in much smaller spaces, but we have to work on ways to represent these computations using integer arithmetic, and that's a whole other area that we study in. You'll study in a DSP course, for example. But let's come back to this issue of the amplitude representation. How does image compression work? Well, image compression takes the representation of the amplitude, which for a typical computer means you're going to have 8 bits for R, G, and B values of the color. So you'll have 3 times 8, or 24 bits per amplitude. And image compression essentially develops ways to represent the amplitude values with less than those 24 bits, because even those 24 bits are too expensive to store images. And you've all seen this when you use a high-quality camera. You get these images which are enormous in size, and then we try to do lossless compression using GIF or lossy compression using JPEG for video or MP3 for audio. But the net effect of all of this kind of stuff is that it generates signals whose amplitude is discrete. The amplitude values can take on one of a finite number of values. And that is what we call a digital signal. It's a signal whose amplitude and time scale are discrete. Meaning, in addition to time being a discrete variable, the amplitude of that signal is also a discrete variable. That's what we call a digital signal. Most signals that we deal with are, in fact, digital signals, but mathematically, in this course, we're going to assume that they're continuous in amplitude and not deal with this problem of being digital in amplitude.
Isn't there a problem with saying that they're continuous in amplitude, like, and having so many digits of precision, like when we do math on these things? Like, if I say that somebody is 65.374 centimeters tall,
mm-hmm.
and there's like 5 digits of precision there, well, I mean, that's discrete. We had to stop, like, because there's a whole lot of space
right.
between 65.374
right.
and...
So there's a couple, there's two ends of that problem. So,
can't throw me crazy, right?
One of the things that I used to love to do with my graduate students, who often do not pay proper attention to the number of significant digits, is they will get a data set which looks something like this. And then they'll produce the results of their research, which they cut and paste out of MATLAB, and they'll have numbers like this in their table. You've probably seen this on the web, right? What's wrong with that?
You made up results, basically.
But MATLAB gave me these numbers. They have to be real.
Oh, yeah.
So, you may remember in physics, your physics labs, the professors beat you over the head with number of significant digits and things like that. And that certainly applies. The number of bits you use on the data does influence the amount of precision you have. Now, computers can often generate what appears to be more precision than is really there. I think what you're really worried about is when they generate less precision, right?
Well, What I'm really worried about is, like, I guess the fact that when you make a measurement and you draw the line somewhere, you made it not continuous anymore.
Right, but the
I mean, with calculations aside.
So if you have a measurement of 1.0 and 1.2, and you ask what is the average of these two numbers?
It's 1.1.
The average is 1.1. In some cases, you could do some calculation that says the average value is not cannot be cleanly represented in the original scale, right? If we made this, if you have the number 1 and you have the number 3, and then you want to take 1 over 3, right? You've only got one significant digit here, one significant digit here, but this has potentially, you know, many significant digits.
Right.
So it's okay to begin with data with limited precision and to do computations which produce additional values, but then typically what happens when all is said and done, like with this MP3 player, one of the things I do for the lectures, after I record the lectures, I first of all compress them by about a factor of 10. From what's recorded on that recorder, the lectures usually require about 100 megabytes for the 1 hour lecture, and I compress that down to about 10 megabytes. But then I also change the audio level. I boost them a little bit so that the output level is at a more comfortable volume for your MP3 players. But when I'm done writing all that information, it's written at a fixed precision. It's written at a precision that's similar to what the original data was recorded at. But all the internal computations are done with complete floating point precision. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can actually show that that reduces the amount of error in the final result. But what's not true is that if you start with a certain signal precision or signal-to-noise ratio, and we'll talk later about what that means, here, you can't magically get better than that in your computations. Your computations are always going to add noise. So sometimes if you take a digital file in, you do some stuff in MATLAB that should give you that exact digital file back, and you write the new file and you compare the two, they'll be off in the last digit. And that's because there's been a little bit of numerical error that's caused one bit to toggle on the data. Okay, so we can maybe talk after class a little bit more if you don't mind.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it.
Okay, so it's... let's sort of go a little bit further and talk about statistics. The amplitude of a signal can be modeled as a random variable. So if we consider this audio signal, this happens to be an MP3 encoded audio signal. How would we compute a histogram of the amplitude of this signal? So here I've shown a histogram. How would we actually, if I asked you what is a histogram of the amplitude of that signal, I think many of you who've had statistics should be able to compute that. How would you go about computing that? What is a histogram?
That's a good question.
The time scale shows you the amplitude based on time.
No, not quite based on time.
It's how many, it's the count of how many of the discrete values that x can take.
So this axis is what?
That'll be the x of n equals. Whatever x
this is amplitude of the signal, and we typically, to compute a histogram, we will bin this. We will divide this up into a range and say, well, these are all the samples that fell between 15 and 16. These are all the samples that fell between 10 and 11. So we'll set up some bins, and then we'll count the number of times an amplitude value of the signal falls in one of those bins. Now, why are we interested in a histogram from a statistical point of view?
Because it lets you know how often something happens.
Right, and what do we call that in statistics? If this were a continuous function, what would we call this?
Distribution.
It's often called the probability density function. It's a measure of the probability of individual values of the amplitude. And it's sort of beginning of statistics. It's where it's a representation of the signal that we sort of begin and use. It's where things begin with statistics. Now, why are we interested in that? Well, there's a few things we can do. We can compute the average value of the signal. We can also figure out what values are more likely than others, and then we can sort of optimize or adjust our quantization scheme, our ability to represent that in digital values. We can adjust that to the nature of the data. Now, that's actually done in almost every application. The MP3 player uses a logarithmic amplitude scale to compress audio data. Your video screens use a logarithmic voltage characteristic to when they actually render video. It's not linear. They actually bias your video devices so that the intensity that you see is a logarithmic function. So we use this kind of information to do some analysis and of the signal and then some optimization of the signal. So what would be a reasonable approximation for this histogram? Well, if we knew nothing about the problem, we might say uniform. We might say that all values of that signal are equally likely. But we know, in fact, for audio signals in particular, that's not a good model. With audio signals, we know that small values are more likely than larger values. So the distribution tends to be bunched towards closer to zero. So you might say, well, triangular distribution might make sense. But if you remember, and that's a very poorly drawn Gaussian, but if you remember from your statistics, we tend to want to model things as Gaussian distributions. And in fact, modeling that audio signal as a Gaussianly distributed random variable is a pretty decent thing to do. Audio signals are not quite Gaussian in amplitude, but that's a very common approximation that we will make. And as you'll learn in engineering, we tend to use Gaussian models for many, many different kinds of data. Whether we're modeling the stock market, whether we're modeling baseball scores, or whether we're modeling speech and audio data, we use Gaussian models extensively.
Is the Gaussian the same as the normal distribution?
Normal. Gaussian and, okay, and normal are synonymous. In your statistics class, you tend to learn them initially as normal. Mm-hmm. It's just one of these historical notational things. So what are some examples of random variables? Well, we have continuous valued random variables, uniform, P of X is equal to 1 on some range, triangular, P of X is, that's the shape that I showed on the previous slide, or Gaussian. You may remember the form of a Gaussian distribution. You have X minus mu, mu is the mean. You have X minus mu squared over 2 sigma squared. Sigma is the standard deviation. Sigma squared is what we call the variance. And then we have the equivalence of these for most of these, we have the equivalence on a discrete side. For a discrete random variable, we can say a uniform distribution is 1 over m on the range 0 to m minus 1. For a triangular distribution, we can have a similar function. Now, these are distributions which would describe the amplitude of the signal, not the time domain of the signal. So an important part of the specification of a random variable is its probability density function. You may recall density functions have to integrate or sum to 1. That's an important constraint for the density function. A Gaussian distribution is completely specified by 2 values, its mean and variance. And this is one reason it's a popular and useful model, is it has a very small number of parameters associated with it. Quantization systems take into account the distribution of the data. They model the signal using these kinds of functions, and then they optimize the quantization technique based on the statistics of those distributions. And this is studied extensively in areas like communications and information theory. A very simple example of this, in the early days when they were transmitting digital signals over the telephone lines or over the transcontinental links and such, they would have to put these analog amplifiers and along the links to amplify the signal, because as you send the signal over wire, its amplitude falls. So they went and dropped all these analog amplifiers, 30-mile spacings across the bottom of the ocean, for example. And they started to transmit digital data over these lines, and they found out that when they turned the system on and tested it, everything worked fine. But a month or two later, something was wrong and they had to go and power cycle all these amplifiers. So they did that all over again, and sure enough, another month went by and they had the same problem. And they started to get really tired of having to power cycle these amplifiers. Well, they eventually traced this down and they came to understand that when you send a digital signal, now many of you will think of a digital signal as looking something like this. What's wrong with this signal? This is kind of a nasty signal. Even though you can say it's digital, it's either 0 or 1. But over time, what is the average value of that signal?
1/2. So it turns into 0.
It's certainly going to be greater than 0, right?
Yeah. Less than 1.
So what happens to electronics when you expose them to a signal whose DC value is greater than 0 for a long period of time?
They charge.
They charge, because electronics has capacitance. So what was happening is these amplifiers were drifting because they kept getting hit with this non-zero DC value. Okay, so you're thinking, I can solve that problem and still have time for lunch. I'll just do this. Something like this, where I'll just shift this down by a fixed amount. What's wrong with that?
You could stay high for a really long time.
So what's going to, in that case, what's going to control the DC value of the signal? If you set zero logic to be, let's say, minus 1 volt and one logic to be plus 1 volt.
Just.
What's going to control the DC value of that signal?
The average of ones versus the average of zeros.
Which makes it data dependent, which makes it signal dependent. Right. So they did that, so junior engineer did that, and that didn't work either. Because on the average for voice signals, which they were transmitting at the time, there was still a non-zero DC value. So, any ideas how you can get around that? So they did one additional step, which turned out to be really cool, and it actually solved this problem. All through the magic of digital signals.
Parity bits?
What?
Parity bits?
Something close. They basically adjusted the code words that were sent so that on the average value of a bit was at 0.
Yeah.
And they did this by simply reordering the digital values they assigned to different amplitudes. So that on the average, when you looked at a random chunk of bits, the average value was approximately 0 at all times. Now that required statistical models of the amplitude, and that required a little bit of coding theory to understand how to represent signals. But that resulted in a standard which is now known as the Mu-Law encoding standard, where they have a specific way they assign amplitude to bits. They permute the bits so that on the average you see the same number of ones and zeros.
So they just analyzed like the average conversation or whatever, and
they collected audio data and they did probability models for the amplitude values, and then it turns out for audio signals, for voice signals, the amplitude distribution, it's almost Gaussian, but it's a little more peaked than Gaussian, and then they developed a quantization scheme that essentially optimized this distribution. They looked at how frequently things were occurring and what those values were. And then on top of that, they then assigned, they represented this as, let's say, 0101, but this value was permuted maybe 1101 or something. They permuted the values so that you made sure that the bit sequences on the average were always equal numbers of ones and zeros. Whereas if you just did a straight linear encoding, the lower values are going to be more probable than the higher values, so you're still going to have this imbalance of ones and zeros. Very simple example. Of course, the story didn't quite unfold that way. Before you drop amplifiers across the ocean, you study things carefully. But this was actually a problem in the early days of digital transmission, and one of the problems AT&T had to solve. I don't know if you've ever seen this on your audio amplifiers at home. used to be audio amplifiers had the same problem. It was very good to power cycle your stereo every now and then. And this drift is a real problem with most electronics, particularly with AD converters and things. These audio players, if you left them on for hours, probably would have the same problem. Most of these portable electronics devices, they get around this because they know you're going to be turning the device on and off pretty regularly. But if you leave these devices on long enough, they'll eventually lock up. I don't know if you've experienced that, but you know, it's with portable devices, you can get away with a lot. So we've talked a little bit about this concept of a mean, and you may recall that the mean value of a random variable can be computed by integrating its probability density function. So mathematically, this is the integral of x times p of x over the range minus infinity to plus infinity. That's what we call the mean. And an example of that, if we take a uniformly distributed random variable, so if p of x is equal to a constant 1, and we integrate that from 0 to 1, so this is a random variable whose probability distribution is uniform from 0 to 1. And we all would look at that and say, well, the average value should be 1/2. And this is essentially a proof of that. If you integrate from 0 to 1 of x times p of x, you get 1/2. The mean value of a discrete random variable. Discrete is nice. Many of you are going to be a little bit afraid of discrete because you're going to see these sums, but discrete is nice because you just have to add things up. You don't have to integrate. So with discrete random variables, we just sum x times p of x, and we can compute the average that way. But we can also compute the average with discrete random variables just by summing up the variable and dividing by n. There's a little bit of difference between these two theoretically, but for practical purposes, to get the average of a random variable in the discrete world, you just take a whole bunch of them and add them together. And here we show that for a discrete random variable, we do the same calculation and we can get at the average of that random variable. Now, one of the things we're going to learn in this course is that the average value of a signal, this thing we call a mean or mathematical average, is actually the DC value of the signal, which represents the value of the frequency response of that signal at 0 hertz. And that's important because in a lot of applications, we try to make the DC values equal to zero. And we can adjust the design of our system to do that if we have a nice way of measuring that mathematically. Now, a couple other quantities that we'll talk about quite a bit are variance and standard deviation. The variance of a continuous random variable can be computed as, this is actually the expectation of the square. So mathematically, this is the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of x minus mu sub x, where mu sub x is the average value of that random variable. We take the square of that, multiply it by the probability density function, and integrate. That's how we get the variance of a random variable mathematically. So we can go through that calculation for a uniformly distributed random variable. I'll skip the details, but you can follow them here and show that the variance of this random variable is 1/12. For a discrete random variable, we do a similar thing. We take the sum of x minus mu squared and multiply by the density function and sum. But you, of course, may also be familiar with computing this using a sample variance, which is just x minus mu quantity squared and sum that up. You can do all these computations very easily in MATLAB. You can also do them very easily in Excel and tools like that. The standard deviation is just the square root of the variance. But soon we'll see that the variance is related to the correlation structure of the signal, the power of the signal, and eventually what we call the power spectral density. So another nice thing that we'll do in this course is we will relate these statistical concepts to notions like frequency response, power, and some of those concepts that you're used to in engineering, in your engineering or electronics classes. I'll skip the slide on covariance and correlation, but why is correlation so important to us as engineers?
It tells you how a change in one like signal affects a different signal, like how they're correlated.
So give me some real world examples why we're so interested in correlation.
We want to know whether one thing affects another.
Okay, that's an analytical approach. Give me a more mercenary reason why we're interested in correlation.
Okay.
So who are the sporting fans in the class? Why are you interested in correlation? You use this all the time. Who bets on sports? Anyone want to be honest about that? Sporting fans are obsessed with correlations, right? So what's been one of the in the football playoffs this year? What's been one of the big discussions? There's two factors they've talked about quite a lot in determining the outcomes of the playoffs. One was home field advantage, right? This has not been a good year for home field teams with home field advantage. Normally, home field advantage is very highly correlated with winning a game. That didn't work so well this year. What's the second one?
Turnovers.
Well, what about wild card? Normally, when a team enters the playoffs as wild card, they don't stand a good chance of winning. This year, they're thinking we might have two wild card teams in the Super Bowl. These are all good examples of correlation. Sports and other kinds of betting scenarios thrive on correlation. I was mentioning the other day, I was reading a book this past week about somebody who looks at the correlation between search terms and world events and things and can predict your behavior based on the things you're searching for on the internet. That's another example of how correlation is used. We'll talk about Gaussian noise later, so I think I'll stop here for now, and we'll come back to some of these. Spend some time looking at the slides. They're pretty easy to understand. Yeah.